Being a Dhamma teacher is a kind of weird occupation. I'm not sure if it's registered in the Social Security as a valid lifestyle option. Probably should be. But one constantly finds oneself in the position of trying to talk about the untalkable, to speak the unspeakable, or as some people say, to F the ineffable. And one should always have a lot of humility and caution about the way that one does this, both as a speaker and also as a listener of Dhamma. We become so accustomed to thinking of Dhamma as like a kind of a universal law or something like that. But you know, Dhamma is always grounded in human beings, human reality, human experience. When we talk about the principles of Dhamma, dependent origination or the Four Noble Truths and so on, these aren't things that you can discover in the world like a rock or something like that. They're not things you can trip over. There's a famous moment in the history of Western philosophy when there was a discussion among the philosophers. I can't remember who this was now, I can't remember his name, but they're discussing the idea of idealism, which is the idea that the world outside doesn't really exist and only the mind exists, and the world outside is just an illusion. And one of the philosophers there said, I refute it thus, and then he kicked a brick. So the Four Noble Truths and so on, they're not things that you can trip over in that way. They're not things that you can kick in order to prove that they exist. But they're what we call, in Pali or in technical language, they call an upadaya panyati. It's like a derived concept, which is a way of saying that when we use these words, Four Noble Truths and so on, that these are generalizations or abstractions from experience. Same thing with dependent origination and so on. These are like generalizations, it's derived from observation. So in the same way as, for example, we talk about, say, language, and we have like rules of grammar. And of course, you know, traditionally or conventionally, people think rules of grammar are rules that tell you how you should speak or how you should write and what's right and what's wrong language. But more and more in recent years, people have come to realize that the rules of grammar really should be descriptive. So there's more of an emphasis on that rules of grammar actually describe how to use a language. And so there comes to be more tolerance of the idea that within any linguistic community, there are many different ways of using a particular language. The same thing with like the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, these kinds of things. When we use these words to describe these things, and these are generalizations based on individuals' experience. But of course, the way that these things are experienced is quite different for everybody. We all suffer. So as a generalization, we can say we all suffer. But the particular way that we suffer is completely unique to everybody. Everyone has their own particular way of suffering and being happy. Everyone has their own way of hating. Everyone has their own way of forgiveness. There's not like one sort of underlying thing which we can call hatred or any of these kinds of things. But these are languages and concepts we use to be able to try to communicate our experience. And of course, it's very difficult to do this because everyone's experience is different. Even if you really try to pin down these things, the more you try to pin them down, the harder they become. And again, we were talking a little bit about this today, that, you know, for example, think about Buddhism, we think about basic ideas like there's Theravada and there's Mahayana, but the more you try to look at these things, the more you realize what actually are these things. So there's one article in the book I just read is called What, If Anything, is Mahayana? And because the more you try to find out what Mahayana is, then the less there is that you can actually pin down. And that title was actually derived from a title of a book on evolutionary theory in biology. And originally the title was What, If Anything, is a Rabbit? And then somebody wrote a response to that one called What, If Anything, is a Zebra? And then you say, well, you know, zebra's like a striped horse. Well, if I get a horse and I paint stripes on it, does that make it a zebra? You say, well, no. So the more you start to think about it, the more difficult it is to pin these things down. You know, if we can't even decide what a zebra is, for goodness sake, how on earth can we decide what the Four Noble Truths are? I mean, a zebra would seem to be fairly distinct, wouldn't it? I mean, you don't usually mistake a zebra for something else. usually fairly clear. You see a zebra wandering into the monastery, you don't think, is that a zebra or a wombat? You know, no, it's definitely a zebra. And yet when you start to look at that, then the closer you look, the less easy it is to actually say why it's a zebra. So this is one of the things that we find as our search for truth goes on, and the more deeply we start to see the truth, the more cautious we are about what we can say about the truth. And again, I was talking with Tom this morning, and you know, he was saying through this Ajahn Chah's teaching of it's not certain, like everything's not certain, not sure. You know, it's not sure, good's not sure, bad's not certain, right's not certain, wrong's not certain. All of these kinds of things. Whatever you take is not certain. I remember one of his passages where Ajahn Chah said, even if you become a stream enterer, that's still not certain. And if you become an arahant, then that's like really uncertain. That's a very beautiful way of putting it, because we think that, you know, becoming an arahant is not like a search for certainty or something like that. But, you know, becoming an arahant is like a full understanding of impermanence. It's a full understanding of the uncertainty of things. And also quite as a very practical like lesson or warning is, the more we start to tell us ourselves that we're certain about these kinds of things, the less real they become. And so, you know, one of the great traps in the spiritual life is this thing of overestimation, believing that one has attainments or whatever in samadhi or wisdom or vipassana or, you know, penetration to the Dhamma of various levels and what have you. And that we start to think that somehow we have these things. And in my career as a monk, I've heard some truly astounding feats of overestimation of people who are, you know, completely untogether in every way, and yet who believe that they're literally arahants. Not only arahants, but with all the psychic powers and everything like that. And so you say, well, yeah, Ajahn Chah was sort of something to that. Yeah, it was really uncertain, you know. So when we're developing, especially if you're developing wisdom through meditation, developing pasana inside of our practice, and remember that this isn't a search for rocks. So that kind of inquiry that we're looking for in vipassana, it's not a search for things that we can kick and say, oh, I know it's there because I can kick it. It's not the search for being able to tell the difference between a rabbit and a zebra. It's not so that I can distinguish, well, I can tell between a rabbit and a zebra, but what about the difference between a rabbit and a hare? It's a bit harder to tell, isn't it? What about different kinds of rabbits? And so on. This is not the point of vipassana practice. So it's not about like finding those things that we call the Four Noble Truths, as if, you know, the Four Noble Truths can be another thing on the same level as a rock or something like that. This is one of the, in philosophy they call a category mistake. It's the same kind of error that the Christians use when they try to talk about God as like the, you know, intelligent design and so on, and they try to say God is like a kind of a tinker or a craftsman who's standing outside the universe and kind of making it in the same way that a potter would make a clay pot. If God is anything, it's just not that kind of thing which acts in that way. That's like putting God on the same kind of level as the world. It's treating him as just like another thing. And so it's not only, of course, bad science, but it's even worse theology. At least scientifically, at least, it's, you know, scientifically it's at least conceivable that we could imagine a God who actually created the universe. But theologically, it's even much more clear that if there was a God that created the universe in that way, that God wouldn't be capable of being a worthy object of worship and of consideration and being the highest good in the world. It's worse theology than it is science. And so in Buddhism, when we start to look at things like dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths, if we start to see these things as being on that same level, then we're committing the same kind of category mistake. So this is why there's a very important difference between like understanding the expressions of Dhamma, the way Dhamma manifests, for example, in a particular person, their views or their experiences, or else perhaps in a certain book or in a certain school or whatever it may be. And each one of these will manifest or express or show the Dhamma in some way. But But of course, none of these is really like the point of what the Four Noble Truths is, and so on. So that's why in the work I do, if I do a lot of text critical study of like analyzing and deconstructing the way that Dhamma and expressions of Dhamma manifest, and so looking at how these actually work in context. So putting Dhamma in the context. And the point of these is not, this is not to sort of deconstruct the Dhamma as such. It hasn't really got anything to do with the Dhamma, in a sense. It has to do with the interaction between the Dhamma and the world, that kind of interface, and with the fact that we normally take that interface, that connection between the Dhamma and how it gets manifested and expressed in various ways, we normally just take that so for granted. You know, we think that there are things like jhanas, for example, and we try to meditate to get this kind of thing called a jhana, and have I got it or have I not? You know, we forget that jhana is just a word to describe a certain kind of experience, a certain spectrum of experience. Jhanas themselves, a jhanic experience has certain very important features in common that we use to classify it. But not every jhana is identical with every other one, of course not. They're all different. The way that it's experienced is different. There's a certain spectrum or range of material that we call like the four jhanas. Same thing happens in, for example, in Vipassana schools. They teach a lot about these Vipassana jnanas. It's not something that I talk about very much, but like a sequence of different knowledges which are supposed to arise one after the other as one's developing Vipassana. Of course, if you look at how these things are described, then it's very difficult to relate that to your actual experience. And practically speak, in those traditions, when they practice in those ways, and of course the ability to recognize and identify different Vipassana jnanas, of course, is extremely difficult, quite arbitrary in many ways. It's very problematic. So we have this idea that Buddhism presents us with this kind of detailed and very clear and very explicit mind map, showing us where all, you know, what our mind is like and what all the different parts of our mind are and how they work together and things like that. And we somehow assume that this is an expression of some kind of ultimate truth. But of course, the more we look at Buddhism, the more this idea becomes problematic, because we see that, for example, many different schools have produced many different mind maps. And we wonder, well, hang on, if they're all based on direct meditative experience, then how can they be telling us quite different things? And we know that they're different because they used to argue about it, and they used to accuse each other of being wrong all the time. So we begin to wonder, like, where do these things actually come from? What do they mean? So I think it's very important to engage with this process. It's not good enough to simply say, oh, well, that's just all irrelevant. Because what happens then is that what we tend to do almost always is that we actually have in our own mind some kind of view about the Dhamma and what it is and what it isn't. And that view we have in our mind is usually very primitive and very crude. We have a very simplistic and very naive idea of what Dhamma is, and we try to implement that in practice. And if we're resistant to the idea of learning more about Dhamma and different perspectives on Dhamma, then we won't learn anything that's going to challenge that view. So I think it's important to get different ideas, different ways of looking at Dhamma, not because we have to find out necessarily that one of them is absolutely right and one of them is absolutely wrong, but because by doing that process, then we learn to get more flexible in how we approach the truth. We become more humble in our own assessment of our own understanding of the truth. We know how often, how easy it is for us to be wrong. We know that so many people who have much greater wisdom than we do, they still manage to disagree with each other about what the Dhamma is and have different points of view. So we get more and more humility about actually what the Dhamma is, and more openness to learn from what it is. And of course, this is the essence of what a meditative experience is about, is about having like a humility and openness to learning. And once I read a distinction was made, I think it was David Bohm, the physicist, made a distinction between intellect and intelligence. And intellect is from a Latin form, which is a past participle, and it's like means something. It's like a closed thing. It's like a closed or finished structure. It belongs in the past. Whereas intelligence is like an active thing. It's not the past participle form, but it's an active like faculty or mode of using the mind. So this again is the difference between like having a Dhamma which is like wrapped in plastic and presented to us and like, you know, freeze dried, ready for consumption, just pop into the microwave. Instant TV dinner, you know, you just pop in for a 3-day Vipassana retreat and then you just like bung it in the microwave and you've got an instant TV dinner, there it is, it's all ready for you with all the peas and the salt is already in there, you don't have to do anything. So this is how we think about it. Actually, it's not like that at all. Dhamma is not like frozen TV dinner. It's much more like a vast ocean that we have to plunge into. Or perhaps even better than saying we have to plunge into it, but it's more like waking up and realizing that all our lives have been spent in this vast ocean. So the process of gaining wisdom is not the process of sort of making a checklist of facts which one can say, you know, okay, that's a zebra, that's a rabbit, okay, I've seen the zebra, I've seen the rabbit, what's next? That's not what wisdom is about. It's got nothing to do with wisdom. Wisdom's about developing that flexibility and like bigness of mind that can be open to receive the truth. So when we are trying to develop wisdom in our meditation, there's really, of course, there's many different ways of doing this. One way of doing it is to like take a particular Dhamma category or teaching and then consciously use that for investigation. Okay, so usually probably the most straightforward or simplest is to use the six sense bases. And so you just focus on eyes, on seeing. Usually if you're meditating, maybe your eyes closed or half closed, you can maybe see a little bit dimly. And just focus. You could do that now. Just focus on what seeing is like. It's this experience of seeing. Ignore hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and stuff going on in the mind. Just what is that seeing like? Try to identify that as clearly as you can. What is that quality of that experience like? And as we focus on that, then we realize, of course, that seeing in a way is completely different from anything else. It's not like hearing. It's not like smelling. It's not like tasting. It's not like touching. It's not like anything else. It has its own very like individual character. So in some ways, we can think about that conceptually. We can analyze that. For example, you know, seeing has like this spatial component, right? The way that things, like many things present themselves at the same time to the sight, differentiated in space. And that's not something that, for example, hearing is different. Hearing, everything sort of appears at the ear. And we can differentiate in space to some degree, but not in the same way as with sight. So we can analyze it, but this way of analyzing it always leaves something over. It doesn't actually touch, like, what is the taste of that? It's like talking about what is the taste of lasagna. You know, you can analyze it and say, well, it's salty or it's not salty, it's hot or it's not hot, it's got garlic or it doesn't, it's got a particular kind of cheese or it doesn't, or whatever. But there's something left over. The actual taste of it is not there. It's not in that analysis. So we can further analyze it according to like the different ways the Buddha talked about sense experience. For example, eye forms and eye consciousness. So, you know, we can consider this, reflect on this. For example, as we sit here, what we actually see is the forms. It's in a sense external. These lights, shapes, colors. This is what we actually see. And so we can in our minds differentiate that out, like tease it out as if we were like eating a lasagna and teasing out the saltiness of that. Of course, it doesn't exist by itself, but conceptually we can analyze it. And then we think we can reflect on the eye. Of course, we can't see the eye. We can't hear our ear. We can't smell our nose. We can't taste our tongue. We can touch our body. That's the difference. But usually we can't see these things. We can't see our eyes unless we look in a mirror. So how do we experience our eyes? Partly we can experience it through touch, can't we? Partly we can experience them as a concept and a memory. So, and then the eye consciousness is the actual, the awareness, like the inner awareness of these colors and so on. And that again has its own particular flavor, its own particular taste. So we can use these ways of analyzing visual experience and then go through one by one all of the senses. And so this is like doing vipassana on like a conceptual level. And then, for example, you can combine this with the various other contemplations like the anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, suffering and not self. And so you can divide, you know, eye consciousness, and then the forms are impermanent, and then you can investigate them as suffering and then as not self, and so on. Or you can see them as empty, or you can see them as dependently originated and so on. Different ways of contemplating them. But there's a difference. This is not like a, you know, purely intellectual, like thinking about them. But this is like experiencing it and then analyzing experience as you're experiencing it. So this like has a component of experience and a component of conceptualizing as well. And so, you know, there's many different ways that this kind of like active or deliberate vipassana can be done. And so this has a lot of benefits and will bring about a lot of use in the mind. It will give you a much deeper understanding of what the Buddha was talking about when he was talking about these things. It'll cause you to question those categories and the things you take for granted, just like we question it. What is a zebra? And it will help you to stay close to that experience by using the concepts. Then the concepts themselves become like a signpost or a direction, or like the classic simile in Zen is they're like a finger pointing towards the moon. And so we're still using those concepts and so on, but we're using them to point towards the experience. So we're staying close to the experience even while we're still thinking about it. In a way that's similar to how we're doing the metta meditation. You know, we use the words, may I be happy, because they're just words. But we're using them in a way to try to evoke the experience. And as the experience becomes deeper, the feeling of metta becomes deeper, and we're gradually able to settle in and sink into that, and the words will gradually recede in importance. So that's another way that we can approach vipassana meditation as well, is using the words, the language of the mind, in order to point us closer to the truth. So while we're doing this, then stuff happens. And as one of the kind of interesting things about meditation is that, I don't like to make these distinctions too hard and fast, but generally speaking, in doing samatha meditation, the actual subjective experiences that you have tend to be more predictable and more kind of normal, I guess. Whereas in vipassana meditation, things happen, can be very weird and very unexpected. This isn't a black and white distinction by any means, but it just tends to be that way. And so when the mind sort of drops down, it's as if when you drop down to a new level of wisdom that the kind of weird monsters emerge from the mind and start manifesting in different kinds of ways. And so you may find yourself, you know, lying on the walking meditation path at 5 o'clock in the morning crying your eyes out. Or something like this. It's not unusual or unexpected. It's very kind of normal, active, normal behavior in a meditation monastery. And if you come across people who are doing these kinds of things, then just be respectful and give them some space. Don't go and call the funny farm, okay? Only if they start doing it regularly. Usually you do it once or twice. So these kinds of things are very normal. And, you know, maybe sometimes you have to have some good screams. And this is one of the great unrecognized advantages of a forest monastery, is that you can have a good scream. And, especially caves are very wonderful for that. Sometimes if you're in kutis and, you know, there's people not too far away from your kutis and that, and then they can hear these screams in the middle of the night, then it can be a bit disturbing, you know. But, usually you just reflect, oh, Venerable's obviously progressing in their insight. Pujom, when I was staying in Thailand, I stayed at a monastery called Pujom Kom, and that's very good for that, because the kutis are all very far apart from each other. So you can have like a really, really good scream. No one ever hears you. It's great. So these kinds of things, they happen. And it's best not to think about them too much. Just let them come and let them go according to their nature. But it is quite normal that it's almost like when one of the things that happens if you're doing insight meditation is that when the insight actually happens, that there's almost like a seizure or reaction. The mind like clenches up or repels itself away from the insight. Insight is difficult to take. So when it actually happens, when the mind breaks through to something, then there's this kind of almost instinctive fear or distrust, and the kind of mind clenches up, and of course that stops you from really resonating with or absorbing into that insight. Insight's something that happens, but then you have to stay with it to let it, happens like at a moment. You have to stay with it to let it absorb in or soak in. You know, it's like if you just plunge something into a tub of water and then pull it out immediately, it doesn't have time for it to soak in. And so this is why, one of the many, many reasons why samatha practice also is very important to do in balance with the vipassana, because when we have the samatha as the smoothness of mind, the bigness of mind, and when the insights happen, then the mind doesn't get afraid. And you can take it in. And then sometimes it just everything just drops away. I remember when I did my first retreat, doing this vipassana retreat in Chiang Mai, and you know, I never had any experience of these kinds of things, and just at the many, many strange things happening in that retreat. So many strange things. I remember one thing happened after the end of the retreat, and the day after. Wasn't even the day after, it was like that the retreat finished that morning, officially, after like 4 or 5 days without sleeping, and then you're officially off the retreat, but still do some meditation, and then I remember just sitting there, and because you're not on retreat, not trying to do anything anymore, and then just sitting, and then just everything just fell away, and it's just like the whole bottom fell out of my world, and you're sort of looking at this kind of endless well, just looking down this well where you used to be, and you're thinking, what's there anymore? You can't, you just see, there's just emptiness there. But, you know, again, this is just like a perception. This is just another way of experiencing things. After a while, that perception fades away. And you can't control these kinds of things. The important thing is that when they happen is that one shouldn't be afraid or worried about it, but is able to accept it and just be with it. And the more you can just be with it, then you'll find that if you can be with it, it will stabilize, it will become more clear. And then we'll kind of, you know, later on, then maybe another kind of perception, maybe drop down to a deeper level, or a different kind of perception or understanding. This is the way that insight tends to go. It tends to kind of sneak up on you from behind. And the things that you're looking for, they're not the way that it actually happens. You know, so we hear these Dhamma cliches, we hear about impermanence, and okay, so we think we know what impermanence is. But when we actually experience impermanence, then it's something that's actually quite different. Again, I remember just one experience I had when I was in Phu-jung-kom, and you know, some of these experiences which you have in meditation, that years later, you know, I can remember exactly where I was sitting, when I was sitting, what time of day it was, all of these kinds of things, and exactly what happened. This is some kind of memory which imprints it very, very deeply. And it's one occasion, and it's, I was just sitting meditation, and it was such an ordinary experience, but there was something in my mind, I can't remember what it was, a thought or an image or a memory or something, and then I just watched it disappear, and it was just one of the most ordinary things, but totally overwhelming, just to watch this one thing actually end, and that was just this startling or revolutionary insight, and you realize how rare it is to really see the ending of something. How weird it is, how unusual it is. And so just like one stark moment, just like coalesced, like the meditation or mindfulness just coalesced at that one moment, and just one moment of stillness and seeing, and then something ended in that stillness and seeing. And then that was it. It was just a couple of seconds. But that in that couple of seconds was like a clear seeing of impermanence of something. And that was just so profound for me. I can still remember it more than 10 years later. I remember it very clearly. So this is why these things are so hard to to communicate and to talk about these things in a meaningful way. You know, I can say, well, yeah, you sit in meditation and I saw the ending of something, and everyone goes, yeah, well, so what? It's a big deal. Things end all the time. I can sit here now and just watch things ending. It doesn't mean anything. But it's the way that you see it. It's the way that it actually happened. And so these words that we use, they can be construed in so many ways. It always strikes me when I'm reading Ajahn Chah's teaching is how casually and vividly he talks about such incredibly profound dhammas. And this is one of the things which I think is quite, in a way, is quite misleading about Ajahn Chah's teaching, because he expresses things so clearly and vividly and, you know, so straightforwardly. It seems so clear and so beautiful that it's very easy to mistake it and to think he's talking about something that's just very simple and almost obvious. And like one simile Tom mentioned today is like, you know, the one end of the good and bad is just like two ends of the stick. Pick up one end of the stick is good, the other end of the stick is bad. Dhamma practice is not about picking up the good and the bad, but it's about not picking up the stick in the first place. And that kind of simile, it's so homely and so simple that, you know, we think, oh yeah, okay, that's very easy to understand. But it's a very, very, very profound teaching. So this is like the genius of somebody like Ajahn Chah, that he would talk directly at this very, very exalted level of Dhamma practice, but using very homely, down-to-earth language. So we have to always try and learn Dhamma and understand Dhamma, apply it to our practice, always try and do this with a sense of flexibility. And I remember when I did my physics in year 11 at school, and the first thing that the physics teacher said was, take every sentence I say, you should put a question mark after it. You should take everything as a question. And, nothing is certain in what I say. As far as I can remember, I did physics for 2 years there. I think it was only once my best friend Stuart, who visited the monastery some time ago, he actually questioned the teacher and refuted his doctrine on one particular point, and the teacher went home and thought about it some more, came back and admitted the next day, he said, yeah, you're right, I was wrong. So it did actually happen. But that's the right kind of attitude for a Dhamma practitioner, that everything we hear, we treat it as a question, as something which is opening up a way of inquiry. We don't treat it as a definite and set in stone, set in concrete truth. Of course, the classical source for this is Chulahati Padopama Sutta, with the you know, traveling through the forest and you see the footsteps of an elephant and you think, wow, this looks like the footsteps of a big bull elephant. And you think, well, maybe it's not, maybe it's a she elephant. I can't conclude if it's a bull elephant, because she elephants can leave big footprints too. And then you see the trees knocked over and you think, wow, it must be a big bull elephant. But then you think, oh no, maybe that was a she elephant as well, or something else that did that. So all the evidences and signs that you see, you can't ever conclude until you actually come face to face with it and you actually see, okay, yes, I was right, it was a big bull elephant. Now it's running towards me and screaming, I better run away. That it's very important that you all should read and study that sutta very deeply, that Chulahati Padopama Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and also the Chanki Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya also. It's very similar, very important. And teaching us not to grasp prematurely at our ideas of what the truth is, but to keep this kind of, you have a tentative hypothesis, you formulate a hypothesis, you put it into practice, and you go, but you're conscious of that, you're reflecting on that as you go on. So like, you know, anicca is not like a kind of a thing, you know, impermanence, so it's not like a dogma which we have to believe, it's a hypothesis which we have to test. And so we look, and if we find something permanent, then great, you know, maybe we'll find something permanent. It's like the Japanese scientists who wanted to test the idea, because some physicists say that the proton is permanent, and this is a controversial point in physics, is whether is a proton permanent or not. And if it is impermanent, then at the very least it'll last for so many hundreds of millions of years or something like that. So how do you actually test whether it's going to be permanent or impermanent? So what they did is they built a huge reservoir underneath a mountain in Japan and filled it with heavy water, with water with a special form of hydrogen, which has extra protons in it. So it has extra neutrons in it. And they calculated that in that huge reservoir, there are so many billions and trillions and quadrillions of protons. And it has to be underneath the mountain to shield it from the radiation and so on coming from space and all of these kinds of things. And so they put it in there and they calculated there's so many billions and so on of these things. And according to the most likely theory, you know, there should be one of those billions and trillions of protons should decay every 30 years. So if we set up a measuring or something like that, if we set up our measuring device, then we can watch this lake for 30 years or something like that and see whether a proton is going to decay. And so they built this thing and they're watching it. And then somebody came out with another theory and said, no, if the proton's going to decay, it's going to take you not, it won't be in 30 years, it'll take you 10,000 years to be able to tell it. So the whole thing became a complete waste of time. They would have been better reading some Buddhist suttas and just taking it on faith. Probably impermanent. Very likely. But it's a good attitude, even though that particular experiment didn't really work, but it's a good attitude to take, you know, that we have to see is something permanent or impermanent. And maybe something is going to last for that amount of time, you know, and not just a proton lasts for that amount of time, but if you get like reborn in the Brahma realms or Arupa realms or something, that will last also for that level of time, but also even longer. But that's also impermanent according to Buddhism. So everything that happens to us, then it's not certain. See, it's not satisfactory, it's dukkha, suffering. See, it's not self. You can't identify with it, you can't say it's me and mine. So this is my little talk for this evening, insight, and I hope that's created some confusion and doubting and has inspired you to investigate the confusion and doubt and to realize that that's actually where the problem is. I offer this for your reflection. Anyone has any comments or questions?